Welcome, everyone, to our latest installment, courtesy of the Kollel, Aharon Valea. We appreciate their mysterious sponsorship of our wonderful evening, our delicious food, and now our Torah class, holding out for a hero, Judaism's most mysterious, anonymous hero. So in keeping with Talmud and everything else, we're going to start with source two. I don't know if you ever noticed this, but the Torah always starts with a base. So when you open a Talmud, there isn't a first page. It's always the second. That's just the way Judaism works. So we're going to skip source one. If we have time later, we'll come back. If not, another class calls. So let's start with source two. And here's the context. We, who love gastronomic Judaism, do not like fasts. I think everyone agrees that sometimes they're kind of tough. Now, Baruch Hashem, I have to say that the rabbis were pretty lenient. We don't have like a whole month of Ramadan. I don't think if we had a month of fasting, there'd be a lot of proponents of Judaism today, right? But there was a fast that we fasted just a short time ago, right after Hanukkah. And I guess the joke at the time was, it's probably for all the latkes and jelly donuts that you ate. So we have a fast called Asara B'Teves, the 10th day of Teva, of the month of Tevis. But you might be interested to understand and to learn that once upon a time, there were three consecutive fasts. You're probably thinking, thank God we don't have that today, because we rolled all three into one fast. So it used to be, many moons ago, they fasted on the 8th day of Tevis, sunrise to sunset, the 9th day, and then the 10th day. What is strange is that one of those three fasts is sort of like a mystery that we're going to try to explore tonight. I asked my friend Colombo, Peter Falk, to help us, and we're going to try, between Jessica Fletcher and Peter Falk Colombo, to find out the answer tonight. So let's do the background of the three fasts, what we know. So the 8th day of Tevis. What happened on the 8th day of Tevis? So look at source number two. On the 8th day of Tevet, the Torah was written in Greek during the days of King Ptolemy, and darkness was in the world for 3 days. On the 9th of it, pronoun, the month of Tevet, used to be a fast, it was not known who caused the trouble that happened on it. And this is a direct quote from the Shulchan Aruch, from the Beis Yosef, Rabbi Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch. We call him the Mechaber, the author of the official code of Jewish law, Orach Chaim, which deals with laws pertaining to daily Jewish life, 580. Okay. So the 8th day was the Septuagint. That's the term we use today. If you don't know this story, it's a famous story. King Ptolemy, who was actually a Greek king, related, I believe, to the famous Cleopatra. They were mishpacha, they were family. And they were Greek. And King Ptolemy, it's PT, so the P is silent. King Ptolemy ordered 70 rabbis, the Shivim, and he sequestered them in different rooms of the Alexandria Ritz-Carlton Hotel. And he bid them farewell and said, you will not leave your room until you have translated your Torah, your 5 books of Moses, into Greek. But you will not be allowed to converse one another. You will not be allowed to compare notes. I want the translations from each of the 70. So I know I'll get the truth. And they translated. And there was a miracle happened. And the end result was perfect. But not only that, but there were a little like offensive passages. Like, for example, one of the animals we're not allowed to eat is called the Arnevet. Maybe like Bugs Bunny, the rabbit. But it happened to be that Arnevet was the nickname or the name of King Ptolemy's wife. So if he would read that the Jews think that the Arnevet is tamei, is impure, is unclean, that would be a shtuch, right? That would be an insult to the king, to the king's wife, the queen. And so all the rabbis delicately changed the translation, maybe from Arnevet to whatever Greek is for hare, H-A-R-E, whatever it was. They manipulated the translation in the Greek so as not to offend King Ptolemy and the royalty. Okay. But why was that a day of darkness? As it says right here, darkness was upon the world. What was wrong with this translation? See, what was wrong with this translation is that it was a disaster for the Jewish people and for religious people all over the world. Because once you take the Torah and you translate it into any other language, then all the subtlety, all the nuance, all the multi-layers of the words of what we call the Shon HaKodesh, God's holy language, they're gone. You know the expression lost in translation? It's beyond that. Because once you translate the Torah from God into any language, then it ceases to be the Torah of God. It just is what it is, for better or worse. And so you can make up any explanation you want to the words. So you can get up and say, we want revenge, an eye for an eye, right? And of course, does that mean that? Not at all. It means damages. But if you're just reading the words eye for an eye, you can seek revenge for somebody who cost somebody an eye or worse. So it can become horrific. And then the Septuagint, the Greek translation, went into Latin and to every other language. King James, everybody joined the party. So that was not a good thing. And it was not done by the rabbis willingly. It was at the point of death. Okay, so that was the eighth day of Tevet. So they used to, once upon a time, they would fast on the eighth day to remember that calamitous event. And then the tenth day of Tevet, we're skipping the ninth. The tenth, of course, was when the siege of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar and Nebuzaradan happened around the year 589, 590, before the Common Era. So what is that, about 2,600 or so years ago? They surrounded Jerusalem, lay siege to Jerusalem, that ended in the culmination of the Churban Bayis Rishon, of the destruction of Solomon's magnificent temple in Jerusalem. So that 10th day of Teves is the fast that relates directly to the Churban. So that relates to ultimately Tisha B'Av, the ninth day of Av. They're all interrelated. So the 8th day we fast because of the 70 rabbis and the translation of the Septuagint. The 10th day, Jerusalem lost of the temple. What about the ninth? I mean, it's very strange for the author of the Code of Jewish Law to say essentially, Ani lo yodea, or shachakti. I forgot the reason why. Very strange. So I'm going to share with you some approaches, and then we're going to get to some really, really, I hope, interesting approaches tonight. So let me throw a couple of the approaches up, okay? Why did they used to fast on the ninth day of Teves? So here's a couple that are legitimate, but without a proof. Are you ready? One possibility is that Esther, Queen Esther, was taken on the ninth day of Teves by King Ahasuerus. Because it says in the Megillas Esther, in the book of Esther, it mentions the 10th month of the year, the month of Teves, without specifying which day in the month that Esther was taken. So again, it was a calamitous personal event for poor Esther, and it had ramifications, of course, for the Jewish people, and we know the history of that. But yet, there's nothing in the Megillah to signify that that was the ninth of Teves. Now, we know there is a fast of Esther, but that fast is on the 13th day of Adar before Purim. Has nothing to do with the month of Teves. So again, we could probably put that away, but that is a possibility. Another possibility is that Ezra HaSofer, Ezra the scribe, who brought back parts of the Torah that had been lost, was compared to Moses, to Moshe in his greatness. He died. It was his yahrzeit of Ezra the scribe. And why was it hidden? Because in the same way that Moses' burial place is hidden from us today, Ezra, out of deference for his greatness, we kind of like, on the QT, said we're not going to publicize the fact that Ezra died on this day. Okay, it's a possibility. There's another possibility, which is very interesting. It was the actual original birthday of Yashka, of Jesus. That in the year that he was born, Yashki, as we call him, December the 25th, fell out on the ninth day of Tevet. And so, long term, when you look at the Crusades and Inquisitions, the things that were ultimately done in his name, it was not a happy time for the Jewish people, so they fasted. But why would they keep it like hush hush? Obviously, if they're living in Europe and you're under the dominion of authoritarian church state entities, you don't want to publicize the fact that you're fasting because somehow, right, the 25th of December is a negative thing, the 9th of Teves. So what would you do? You would hide it. The problem with that approach is that there isn't a proof that it really happened that way. There's no real arithmetic. And even amongst the church themselves for many, many years, they went back and forth between January 6th, December 25th, and there's even others. I believe like there's either a Eastern Orthodox Church, which I believe celebrates that day, January the 6th today. Like in other words, if you go to parts of Europe, January 6th and not December 25th is considered that day. So even today you have divergent elements amongst the church when that day is celebrated. So it's not clear that that is real. It's interesting, but okay, we haven't satisfied it.
In reference to...
Yes.
Many people believe that Jesus was not born anywhere near December.
Perhaps in the autumn season, right? In the August?
Spring
season.
Like March, April.
Okay.
Around the time
sure.
of Passover and
right.
Easter and all that, the church deliberately moved it. If he was
right.
born then, they moved it deliberately to be near this time of year.
Hanukkah time and other things.
Saturnalia,
yes.
So that
perfect.
The church
yes.
regulates. So that's what they did. There.
Thank you, Eliza. I appreciate that very much. Lano?
The Orthodox Christmas is the 7th, not the 6th.
It was the 7th. Okay, I read somewhere it was the 6th. Okay.
It's the 7th. That's when my father was born.
Uh-huh. Wow.
February 7th.
Okay. Well, thank you for that context. So you see that to rely on somehow December 25th as a day that the rabbis would concretize a fast, it's a little dubious, right? So we're not there. We haven't found the answer yet. So let's explore now something that's going to bend your minds a little bit, okay? Let's look at source number 3. Rabbi Baruch Frankel to Ummim. He was a rabbi in a place called Lipnik, and he was a very holy man. He died in the 19th century, 1828. He writes that he, this rabbi, and there's another rabbi, by the way, who also found the same source, that this Rabbi Frankel, he found a manuscript in which it says that Simon HaKalpus died on the 9th day of Teves. Simon saved the Jews from a great tragedy in the days of the sinners. His yahrzeit became a permanent fast in Jerusalem. And there's a second source, and again, because they both speak about this man, Simon HaKalpus, or HaKalponi, they identify him as the same individual who died on the 9th day of Teves 2,000 or so years ago. And because of him and his death, it's a significant moment that the Jewish people, the rabbis, ordained that we should have a tainus, a fast on the 9th of Teves to commemorate him. But it's like forgotten, or it was hidden. It's mysterious. So let's talk a little bit about the backstory of who Simon HaKalpus was. I'll give you a little context. He, real figure, but very, very little is known about him. There's a document that was written by Jewish people, and there are different manuscripts and versions of it over the years. There was one from the 8th century that Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, clearly had access to, because we're going to talk about it in a moment. But this manuscript is called Toldot Yeshu. Essentially, it means like the life and times of Jesus. But it's done more from a Jewish rabbinical perspective, but not all of it is entirely reliable. It's not the best, but parts are very reliable. They speak about this man, Simon HaKalpus. And who was he? He was a Tana. He was an author of a Mishnah. Now, just to contextualize with you, okay? The Mishnah was written down in the time of a man named Rebbe. Rabbi Judah the Prince, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Now, why did he write down the Mishnah? Because of Roman persecution, there was a real clear and present danger that if you have what's called the Torsha Ba'al Peh, the oral tradition, which was passed orally by design and not allowed to be written down, and that was essentially all of Judaism was predicated on an intimate knowledge of this oral tradition. If the Romans and their draconian penalties against the teaching and dissemination of Torah would ultimately succeed, what would that mean for the Jewish people? That if one generation passed and all the rabbis who were the transmitters of the law were wiped out and there was no hard copy somewhere, it would be the end of Judaism. It'd be over. So Rabbi Judah the Prince got all the greatest rabbis of his generation together, and they got great manuscripts that had been originally put into print or on parchment, if you will, there was no printing press, by people like Hillel and Shammai and Rabbi Akiva, the greatest of the great. And they got all the rabbis together, and under the direction of this amazing man, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince, who was on the level to be Mashiach in his generation, to be the Messiah, because he was from the house of David. That's how great he was. And this magical man, Rabbi Judah the Prince, redacted all of these teachings. It was a huge project, and it became the centerpiece of all of oral tradition. We call it today the Mishnah. And that Mishnah, the six orders of the Mishnah, if you've ever remember that song, if you're ever up late on your Passover Seder and you get to the end, if you're not too inebriated from your four cups of wine, you may sing a song, Echad Miodea. Who knows one? I know one. Six of the books of the Mishnah. Shisha Sidrei Mishnah. So there's six orders of the Mishnah. That is the framework for all of oral law. And that was redacted. So this man, Shimon HaKapus, who died apparently on the ninth day of Teves, he was on the level of those rabbis. I mean, that's significant. They're called Atana, an author of a Mishnah. It's a great, great privilege to be recognized as such. So he's not a small person. He's a great man. But he died. What did he do? It doesn't say this rabbi in source 3, Rabbi Frankel to Ummim, just says in the days of the sinners that he saved the Jews from a great tragedy. But it doesn't really talk about what that tragedy was. Okay, now we're going to explore something mind-bending. You may or may not be aware that over the last couple thousand years, our Torah, our Talmud, and by the way, the Talmud that we have, the Gemara, is based on this framework called Mishnah. The Mishnah is sort of the very succinct form of the oral Torah, and the Talmud expands it, the Jerusalem, then the Babylonian, and everything is based on that Mishnah, on those six orders of the Mishnah, 63 books in all. So that is the framework for all of Jewish law, all the oral tradition that was given to Moses and Mount Sinai, but it was passed down orally until it was written down by Rabbi Yehuda the Prince that we just mentioned in a moment ago. Okay, so what happened? What happened was they have this backup copy, right? The Mishnah's there, everything's going okay, and in the time of the Gemara, you had censors. Sometimes it was the rabbis self-censoring ourselves for fear of the church being angry with us. Because remember, amongst the church, you had many people who were conversant in Aramaic, who could learn Talmud, could read the Talmud, could read the Mishnah, could translate it. And if there was something that they didn't like, they either clipped it out themselves, or maybe the rabbis, out of fear of prosecution or persecution, they would self-edit the Talmud. So sometimes parts were taken out and then brought back in. I'm going to give you a very famous example. Are you all familiar with the famous prayer that we do three times a day that was written by Joshua and a man named Achan? It's called the Aleinu. Aleinu l'shabayach. Now, you may have noticed in Rabbi Artscroll Shlita, in his version of the Aleinu that we have in our Sidurim, our prayer books, that there's a little parenthetical line that's there, but it may not be familiar to you. We use it, by the way, without parentheses, ironically, on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur in Yom Ha'atzar. But in the daily and Shabbat Yom Tov prayers, it's parenthetical. Chabad has it without parentheses. And the words are, V'heim mishtachavim lahevel v'rik lekel lo yoshia. That these people bow down to a God that is empty and meaningless, to a God that won't save them. Okay? Now that was taken out for hundreds of years from the original text that Joshua wrote. You know why it was taken out? Because of one word. Rik. Resh Yud Kuf. It means empty. Empty. The pit was empty, And Joseph was there in that pit and there was no water, right? Remember that famous pasuk, the famous verse? V'habor reik ein b'mayim. Okay. What is significant about the word empty, that they bow down to something empty? Jewish numerology, it's called gematria. It happens to be that the name of Yoshka, Jesus, in gematria, and the letters reik, empty, are exactly the same number. So the Christian would-be persecutors did not like us saying in the Aleinu that the other people bow down to an empty, meaningless God. They got really upset about it. Now, I have to confess, it can't be that that word empty actually refers to the other guy, to Jesus. You know why? Because Joshua wrote it. You know when Joshua lived? A really long time before Jesus lived. So it can't be that in mind of Joshua, when he wrote that prayer, that he somehow was alluding to someone in the future, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, still out of sensibility, so that there wouldn't be an issue. Guess what the rabbis ordained? Cut it out of the Aleinu. So you may have grown up with like the Birambam or other Siddurim. It's not even in there at all. You're like, what? What is the rabbi talking about? We brought it back after hundreds and hundreds of years of it being edited out. So it's not a new thing that things have been edited. There's a rabbi who I had the privilege of meeting many moons ago who was given access by the Vatican to go down below into the catacombs of the Vatican. They have a lot of really interesting stuff, to say the least, way down below in the catacombs of Vatican City. And this Rabbi Blech was able to retrieve some holy writings that hadn't been seen by Jews in like a millennia or more. Now, he wasn't able to bring back the golden menorah. I'm sorry about that one. And I really apologize that he wasn't given that back, the lost ark. That was a joke. But he did retrieve some things, manuscripts and stuff, that were excerpts from like the Talmud of things that hadn't been seen by a Jew or probably anyone in like a millennia or two. So it's kind of interesting. This source number 4 was redacted and lost to the Jewish people for thousands of years. It's a comment by Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki. It's going to be a little controversial. And it's from a tractate called Avodah Zarah, which deals with idolatry. So listen to this. Wow. This is Rashi commenting. Others wrote their books for them. It's referring to the church. Namely, John, Paul, and Simon Peter. All of them Jews. The word language in his quote refers to grammatica, which was a Latin spoken by priests in the old days. They, the Jews, transformed the language of the Romans, Constantine, etc., into an obscure language in order to separate them from Israel. They, the Jews, who did this, were not apostates. Rather, they acted from the best intentions so as to benefit the Jews. They saw that the Jews were oppressed by the deceitful acts of the followers of Jesus. So these rabbis, whoever they were, impersonated priests and ordained all of the Christian laws and customs and books, as is stated explicitly in the Toldot Yeshu narratives. That's the life and times of Jesus manuscripts that I told you about. Okay, fine. So what is this saying here? And this should not be a shock to anyone. When Jesus died, who were his followers? They were Jews, by and large. I mean, who else would they be? So there was a time that you had a sect called Nazarenes. You can look them up after when you go home tonight. The Nazarene sect, coming after the word Nazareth, they did not like Jewish people very much. They were Jewish, though, 99.8%, meaning Shabbat, Saturday. Kosher, only OU or better. Circumcision, yes. Everything they kept. If you went into shul, they would be there with their talis and tefillin and davening. Literally, okay? What was the one thing they took exception with? The fulfillment of the Messiah or not. But other than that one issue, 100%, you would think they're you, me, and anyone else. Okay? This was a clear and present danger to the Jewish people living in Israel, which unfortunately became known as Palestine because the Romans renamed it to give us a shtok, right? Because remember, the traditional enemy from years past had been the Philistines. So the Romans, in order to sort of desecrate would be the terminology, right? The etymology of that word, to desecrate. They would desecrate the name of Israel into Palestine to shtoch the Jews. Okay, so what happened? What happened was that the rabbis got together and they were scared. They said, oh my gosh, whatever we think or don't think, Judaism may not survive. We may lose hundreds and hundreds of Jews who will follow the Nazarenes and their followers, thinking that this is a kosher form of Judaism, because in almost every respect, it's there. It looks just like it. It tastes just like it. So we need to change it. What do we do? So at one of the meetings, this man, Shimon HaKalponi, rose up. Some say he was the uncle of Jesus, but I don't have a proof for that. I'm sorry. But he could be. Could be a cousin. He is mentioned in some places. Okay. This man, Shimon HaKalponi, rose up and he turned to his rabbis. He said, I will go to the Nazarenes. They'll say, well, what are you going to do? He says, I will have them follow me and change the laws that they follow in terms of their practice. So the rabbis said, wow, you can do this? He said, yes, but on one condition. So they asked, well, what's the condition? They said, if I'm going to do this, and I'm going to essentially become, do you know what a Marano Jew was? The Jews who hid under the penalty of the Inquisition of death by the Spanish church. And they basically outwardly went to church. They outwardly did everything, but secretly they were Jews. Tragic situation. This Shimon HaKalponi was similar to the Maranos of Spain. He said, look, if I'm going to do this, every Jew who meets me is going to hate my guts. They're going to think that I betrayed Hashem, betrayed God. You will know different. I will know different. But the people are not going to know different. History will not know who I really am. So you have to promise me, said to the rabbis, that when I die, I don't lose my portion in the world to come in heaven. That I don't want to give up my chelek, my portion in Olam Haba. If you will promise me that I won't lose that portion in the next world, I'm willing to forego my portion in this world. I'm getting chills just saying this. This is powerful. And the rabbi said, yes, we promise you. And they swore to him. And so Shimon HaKalponi went to the Nazarenes. And what did he do? I won't go into all the details. That's another class. But he convinced them to change their minhagim, their customs. So Shabbat became Sunday. Kosher, gone. Brit Milah, circumcision, gone. All the things that would be readily identifiable by someone who's either a practicing Jew or somewhat practicing Jew, they would, in other words, see differentiation, delineation between who they are and what the Nazarenes are. So from that moment forward, that issue, the clear and present danger of Judaism losing people right and left to the Nazarenes, that was gone. And what happened to Shimon HaKalponi? Shimon HaKalponi became known as Simon Peter. He was the first bishop of Rome and the first pope of the Catholic Church, according to some. And they say, this is amazing, that he had the church built him a little catacomb underneath his place in Rome. And there he would say, I need to communicate, with the Lord there. And he would go down and eat kosher food and keep Passover the best he could, whatever he could do the rest of his life. But he died as an individual who no one today would ever think was a Jew who did this just to help Judaism. And so his yahrzeit, his anniversary of his death, falls on the ninth day of Tevet, and they hid it. Now you can understand why. Because they didn't want persecution for fear of a retribution against the Jews. So they honored this man who gave up everything. So he is Jewish history, perhaps, his greatest unknown hero. Only now we know the rest of the story.